Good morning. Welcome to the Thursday morning edition of the Senate Committee on Revenue. Today we have three bills scheduled. We have, I guess we call, we're referring to this as a taking stock day. We've done some good work this week, listened to a great deal of testimony on Senate Bill 260. We've heard a few 62, 52, and 509 this week. We have some information that's come late, some folks that didn't get a chance to offer their opinions on Senate Bill 252. We have some additional testimony on 509. What I'm going to do is work Senate Bill 509 first, but before I do that, is there anything that you would like to add to the benefit of the staff relative to our next week's agenda and the things that we're going to be doing that week? Mr. Warner?
Mr. Chair, we're working on a preliminary agenda, and that we'll try to finish this afternoon. But on Monday, the Treasurer has asked that House Bills 2124 and 2125 be heard. They're bills dealing with the college saving plan that passed last session, and these are adjustments in that plan. So he will be here on Monday to discuss those. On Tuesday, we have Senate Bills 520 and 521, which were your energy tax credit bills, so scheduled for work session. You have some amendments to look at there. You also have two House bills from the tax collectors, 2029 and 2031, that we've tentatively scheduled. And then on Wednesday, Senate Bill 560, which proposes to eliminate the political contributions credit, a bill from Senator Miller. Thursday is the revenue forecast that will be released here in this committee initially, so that'll be kind of a media day for you as well.
Colleagues, there's some continuity things to pick up with. The House co-chair and myself are meeting Saturday. We'll be discussing the way bills will be transferred back and forth between the Senate and House so that there's some continuity of intention there. Some of the bills that we're working, because they have such a direct impact on the resources that are available for all of the programs in that we're considering for the biennium, we will move to be held against the final forecast in March. But we will also be looking at some of the information that's come from this committee on revenue-changing bills. For instance, this energy tax credit series that we heard last week was, I think, a critical response for Oregon to the energy crisis. We did talk to the co-chairs about moving those bills. We are going to move those bills over the House side. All of these bills that have an effect on revenues will be affected directly by the revenue forecast. One we have next week, it should be very instructive. It'll give us some indications about where we may be going. But most of the resolution on these bills, whether they add to revenue or distribute tax benefits in the form of subsidies or abatements, all will be looked at in the context of the revenue projections in March. May. So that's sort of where we are, and I just wanted you to know that we're bringing bills forward, working those bills, and then holding them so that they fit some context. When we're ready to move them, we'll move them across to the House side. Let's go ahead and open up our public hearing segments for this morning. We're going to work Senate Bill 509 first. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 509. We have Representative Patty Smith here today. Good morning, Ms. Smith. How are you?
Good morning. I'm State Representative Patty Smith. I'm from District 56, which is the beautiful Columbia Gorge. I'm here today to just offer testimony and urge your support of Senate Bill 509, and I thank the Senator, the Chair, for bringing this bill. It's much needed. We need to fund our remote schools, and this is just a change in the language that should have been there, and I just would urge your support, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Let me ask a couple questions.
I was afraid of that.
That may help clarify how it is that 509 comes to this committee, since it originated in your, the concept at least originated in your district.
part of my district.
We were worried about two small schools that essentially were side by side with a district boundary between.
Right.
And we encountered a problem. Maybe you could tell the committee what the problem was.
Well, the problem is the way the language is, that if you're, the remote school funding is you have to be further than 10 miles. It didn't allow for the district boundary. So we have schools that are closer, but they're in other school districts, so they don't qualify for the remote school funding. So it's hurting them funding-wise.
So, and we used the analogy, I think, in our discussions. Geopolitical boundaries in districts mean something in some contexts for the state and mean nothing in other contexts. For instance, anybody that's had to explain to a constituent why the state would not make a response in unprotected land when there was a wildfire, and they did make a response to the same wildfire when it started to burn onto the protected land. And the discussion was, well, that's the fire district boundary. So these fire district boundaries can be inviolable. You just cannot use the resources from one district to another without either a cooperative agreement, and they are just not used at all on unprotected land. There are other districts, hospital districts, for instance. If you have a patron of one hospital district who finds themselves in another area, they may incur additional costs that they would not incur in their own hospital district by virtue of the fact that they're a member of the district. But when it comes to this issue of 8 miles, apparently 8 miles is 8 miles. It doesn't matter whether you're in district or out of district. We felt that was not a consistent application of the way the state approaches these issues. The other thing, of course, is that that 8 mile limitation was related to a period in our legislative past when we were trying to incent or force the collapse or consolidation of districts. We're not doing that anymore. So the 8 mile rule may be just a remnant. Senator Cochran.
Hi, Representative Smith. Welcome to the legislature.
Thank you.
Welcome to school funding formulas.
Thank you.
I'll ask you the same question that I asked some other folks who have spoken on this bill, and it's the classic dilemma that we have, and that is take from one to give to the other. So an adjustment we make here creates a $2.6 million hole in a $5.2 billion that's going to go for education, or it creates a $4 loss per student to other districts. How do you justify that?
Well, I don't think it's mine to justify. I just feel that we have to, our obligation in this state, and clearly it's, we want to educate every child. So it would be truly a hardship to lose these schools just because of a funding formula problem. So I don't know how to address yours except that, you know, we want to address all kids the same. So I would say that maybe if it was a mistake to start with, the money should have intended to be there.
Even freshman Republicans have a hard time saying we need more resources.
Senator Corcoran, again to your question, it doesn't make so much a hole. I mean, the point is that you've got some of these small schools that are not receiving the same amount of funds that every other small school receives, in some cases by virtue of one more left turn or another block between schools, and they got the formula funding. It's an anomaly. It doesn't reduce the $5.2 billion at all. You know, I don't want to say we're rearranging deck chairs because it has such an unfortunate connection with the Titanic.
And no submarine analogies, please, either. Thank you very much.
But in point of fact, we don't have a zero-sum game. What we have is a need out there in the rural communities for small schools that basically we're told or send a message, you know, move, consolidate, or die. They refuse to do any of those three. Now we're stuck with a bunch of folks that are just disempowered because of the formula that we carried forward, I think, irrationally.
But, Mr. Chair, with all respect, it'll cost $2.6 million in your zero-sum game to fix that. And you can say that it's not a zero-sum game, but that's what I've heard. I learned that word from Republican leadership in this building over the last three cycles. So it seems to me that if you're limiting the amount of resources available and then you're moving it around, that's a zero-sum game.
Well, let me tell you, Senator Corcoran, we will spend all the money we will spend all the money. So that's the guarantee that you get in the legislature, is that we will allocate the receipts and spend the money that we have available. I don't know what the number is. I don't think leadership knows what the number is. So in terms of the argument about a zero-sum game, what I'm hoping is that what we produce is a rational approach that we can defend to constituents that they'll understand. And that could be the other definition. The phrase is zero-sum, I think, are meaningless outside the building. Representative, I really appreciate you offering your support to this issue. I appreciate you coming here this morning, and thank you for your testimony.
Well, I thank you for bringing it and the opportunity to
answer
your questions.
I see no other questions, so thank you very much.
Thank you very
much.
We'll
call Dan Barker, please.
Good morning. My name is Dan Barker. I'm the superintendent of Crow Applegate Lorain School District, and I brought with me today two of our community members. On my left is Catherine Smith, the 18-year resident of Crow, downtown Crow, and in my right, is Dean Lively Brooks, a resident and board member for our school district and certain members of board.
As at the Crow Applegate.
Crow Applegate Lorain School District.
Great country. A little wet.
I like the reference to downtown Crow, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that would be either the feed store or the gas station.
I'm just trying to place where that was.
If you turn left at the financial district, you find the downtown.
That would be Bond.
Those are great little communities.
Yeah.
And that's a good school. I know that district well.
Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 509. Obviously, from the spreadsheet you've seen and we've seen, it would benefit our school district a great deal and would help our school district bring us back to some kind of program equity that we've lost over the last 7, 8, 9 years. I prepared for you, not for you, but I shared with you a copy of our brochure that we recently produced. Our school district, and in the brochure, the blue one you have probably in front of you, we display our school district as very, very fine place to go with excellent test results and dropout rate, and it's just a very wonderful place to be. And the reason we produced this brochure is that we're now in the midst of trying to market our school district. Some of you are aware that we have proposed a bill through the help of some of your senators to have open enrollment between public school districts. We're doing everything we can to keep our school district alive in the face of financial decline and declining enrollment. So the marketing piece is just one thing. Then I produced a sheet describing our school district back in 1991 and the school district today. And these are just taken out of the budget that I just cranked this out yesterday. The kinds of things that we've undergone. Now, I've worked in Crow Applegate Lorain School District since 1990. And frankly, when I came there, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. We had a 1-to-11 student teacher ratio. We had a nurse. We had a mechanic. We had counselors. We had summer school, and athletics was free. We had just about everything going for it. And then, of course, we had ballot measure 5. And since that time, we've been cutting, and the funds that historically we kept in our own school districts have gone to Salem and elsewhere, to other school districts across the state. So we've struggled with trying to maintain our programs, and you can see our enrollment has declined, as well as our general fund expenditures, our number of employees, so on and so forth. It's been a real time of difficulty. We're facing right now a shortfall for the coming year of $300,000 to $350,000. We know this because this is a beginning cash balance. Our beginning cash balance this year was $650,000. And we have an unappropriated ending fund balance in our current budget of about $300,000. We know it's going to drop $300,000 to $350,000 for next year. Passage of this bill will actually help us stay even and not have to cut. But if we have to cut, I gave you a copy of our high school schedule. Right now, we're in combination classrooms in all of our grade schools, so about the last place left to cut in our school is at the high school. And you see, we have, if you actually went through and counted them, we have 59 course offerings. Now, this isn't much. It's a small school. I mean, compared to town, where there might be 200 course offerings at Churchill or South. So, but we have 59, and if I cut one teacher to save approximately $60,000, I would cut six classes, two teachers, 12 classes. And as you can see, there are very few multiples there on the high school schedule. We have one choir and one band and one journalism class. And where we go is we cut a class, we're going to cut a program. So that's the kind of point we're at, again, with funding for our school district. And to create Applegate as a small elementary school and inside this formula would truly help us. I'm, of course, open to questions.
Questions from the committee? Your school district is still operating on a five-day week.
We've looked at four-day week. We went to at one point we put the 7th and 8th in the high school. We went to the block schedule in order to get 2 4-day, an A day and a B day, 2 4s, that's 8 periods instead of a 7 periods. We create more coursework. We put the, like I said, we put the 8th grade in the high school and we've since moved them back. We actually considered, have from time to time, off the record, sort of closing a Lorain Elementary School, which is 14 miles away, and bringing the children to Crow because the buses are already coming there. And for the sake of efficiency, we would be much more efficient. But if we did that, we would lose the small and remote school factor that Lorain creates for us, the additional $175,000 that it creates for the district. So we've been put in sort of catch-22 situations time and again about how to operate our school system. And as you guys, folks know, Lorain Elementary is the center of that little community, and Crow is the center of the community of Crow. These folks really aren't interested in having their kids go to other places.
Questions? Senator Clifton?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can certainly speak to Mr. Barker's comments about Lorain. I mean, the Lorain Grange just went ballistic over the potential, just the rumor of closure created a lot of conflict. Dan and I were on the phone a couple times about that, and I was in communication with several members of Lorain Grange, and it just sort of pinpoints the problem within the problem. I mean, this isn't a one community issue, it's a multiple community issue. And I guess the only question I would have, Dan, is the same question that I asked Senator Smith, that I asked people yesterday, is what's your evaluation of you know, I won't mention zero sum, apparently we're not allowed to use that term anymore. So this notion that we have a fixed amount of money that we're going to be doling out here and to benefit you is to have somebody else lose.
I understand that the legislature's only real way of handling the distribution formula is equity in dollars. But I would ask the legislators and senators to look at program equity. For 7, 8, 9 years, we have been giving out programs for other school districts in this state and decimating a truly fine school system in order that others might be brought up. And we understand that. I understand the politics and the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and all those issues. Nevertheless, a little back pay, it's back pay time. We've been giving for so long. We were flat funded for so long. And we know that part of our declining enrollment has to do with our financial situation. We spent last year just talking about, spent 3, 4, 5 months talking with Eugene School District about the feasibility of merging. Talk about creating an exciting morale situation in Crow Applegate Lorraine. You know, it was really sad. Folks don't want to talk about that. And folks aren't interested in moving into an area when they're talking about merger. When they think of merger, they think of school closure. Well, and of course, 4J did say that to us. They said, yes, we'll merge, and yes, we'll close your high school. So we've done a lot, and a lot of it has been done at the expense of equity across the state. And now I ask, you know, maybe it's time for some program equity for kids in our district.
Thank you.
Other questions? Other testimony?
Well, I just wanted to note that I really...
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Dean Rogers, a member of the Crow Applegate Lorraine School Board.
Thank you.
I just feel that this bill was right on target, that rural districts simply do not have the same sort of economies of scale that larger districts have. And I think that this... And if you want a direct comparison and answer to your question, Senator Corcoran, the 4J district is in a similar situation to we are, to where we are. They're losing population and they're losing funding. You know, they're basically fighting. They're looking at closing schools, etc. But their high schools still have possibly 200 course offerings, or say conservatively 150, whereas we have 60, and we're barely eking it out, and we're eating into our reserves. And I see a sort of a limited future unless something turns around. So we're sort of barely making a minimal high school program where they, you know, they're in trouble too, of course, but they're at least able to have larger offerings. And so I think that's sort of evidence, I guess I would say, that it's time to maybe do some reallocation a little bit toward program equity and toward the rural school districts.
That's true. I'll just point out that this is one of three school districts just in Senate District 22 that is really on the fringe. I mean, Marcola, we've talked about before, an unincorporated community, and also Blatchley, their neighbor, is in discussion too, I'm sure, with 4J or adjoining school districts. And, so it really is. I mean, we've had this discussion about the federal force money in that context. It really is a difficulty.
Yeah. Senator, I think you're points are excellent, well made. I appreciate particularly the discussion about how we allocate and the fact that anything that we do affects people at every end of the equation. It does. There's no question about that. That's our job. That's what we're supposed to be doing. This particular situation strikes me as being one of inequity because, but for the fact that their schools are co-located within 8 miles, they would be getting the special treatment that they need to make the critical mass in small school funding. It's because we have already allocated monies that took away from these schools to give to other schools, which is the point of the testimony we just heard from our good Mr. Barker, that we're in this situation. And the question is, do we perpetuate that? The reason we originally did that, I'll reiterate, we thought we would encourage consolidation. I believe we're past that place where we're trying to encourage consolidation. Therefore, should we not lift this construct, which prohibited districts that clearly had small schools and utilizing the small school funding formula that exists everywhere else? I think this only applies to, what, 30?
20
schools left in Oregon. So the question I think that you bring to the table is, you've got two perspectives. Should we take away from all the other school districts to give to these 20 schools, or are we actually just removing an artificial construct that caused these 20 schools to give to the others? And you can look at it either way. I think we need to lift this artificial construct and help these 20 small schools. But,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. It's been great to hear from the smaller districts and helping us, you know, remember or just remind us of what it is your challenges are today. And I also just wanted us not to forget, too, that there were, you know, when I look at the Eugene School District, they were also the losers. They lost a lot of funding in the equalization effort. And when I look at your list here of, you know, the loss of librarians, music teachers, reading specialists, counselors, nurses, all of those happen to the Eugene School District as well. And, you know, so I think that we, and in, under the ordinance, what would happen is we would ask Eugene to lose more. And so I just want us to remember that whenever we tweak the formula, there are consequences. And I don't know that I could go back to the Eugene School District and say, you know, that I know that they would not be supportive of this. And they would say, wait a minute, we've already given a lot to help with equalization in Oregon. We can't afford to give any more. So that's my concern. I mean, I understand the needs. And the solution, in my opinion, is more funding for the whole system. And so, you know, and unfortunately, I mean, I don't know, as the good senator, our chair, was saying, we don't know yet what the final figure is going to be, but hopefully we are going to do right by the K-12 budget. So I don't know, you know, what our final decisions will be, but I'm hoping it's not going to be to take away more from districts to give to others, and instead we'll find some more money to put in to help you guys.
Well, that, again, I think that you've got a good perspective on this issue. We are taking some to give to others. We always do that. Senator Castillo, what I would point out, as long as this structure remains in place that limits these small schools, more doubling the funding for education won't solve the small school funding question. As long as we have a construct that says if you've got two schools within 8 miles, neither one of them is small school funding. Mm-hmm. So the issue here is systemic. It's not a matter of more funding. It's a matter of, do we allow this artificial constraint to basically suppress these 20 schools, or do we take this artificial constraint out of the system and then let them essentially come to the small school funding formula as all of the other small schools in Oregon have already done?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's an equity issue that will not be resolved by more money in the system. All boats would rise with more money in the system. They'd still be constrained.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have, Senator Perkins?
Well, I just have to disagree with you. The fact of the matter is 4J, Salem, Portland would not have any disagreement with a change in the formula to benefit the small schools by $2.6 million if it didn't come out of their hide.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, in fairness to, you know, Senator Castillo's comments, I mean, I think that's really true. You put more money in the system and you get rid of the losers and, you know, you basically, I mean, we're struggling with this with the rapid growing school districts, the loss of enrollment, the small school districts, and the forest communities. So.
Senator Corcoran, I guess I've got a, I think the logic problem appears here. The per capita distribution of funding makes the individual student the multiplier, and putting millions or billions more dollars into the system and distributing it across the system on a per capita basis. For instance, we've been looking at this timber dollars. You know, the special appropriation by Congress that was aimed particularly at rural communities that were timber dependent, that lost local school funding because of the policies, the environmental policies of the Clinton administration. So they appropriated $14.7 million per year. When you spread that over the whole system, it's $24. The point is that's so we get a ratio there. You put 14.5 plus million in, you get $24. The issue here is that these small schools would be the beneficiary of any new additional funds that would come into that school system from whatever source. But you only have 400 students in the system. 341 students. So the relative benefit from all ships rising in the Coral Lorraine Applegate district is not much. The funding and what we've done with all the other small schools is given them a formula that recognizes they need to form. Only 20 are left stranded. This is one of the 20. Another $1 billion So per million, that would be $15 per million. Is that what it works out at?
Dollar and a half
per million is what we get on a per capita basis. So all I'm suggesting is that this, I agree with you that whatever we do moves money around, no matter how where we set that dollar, whether it's 5.1 billion or 5.3 billion or whatever the numbers, whatever we do moves it around. We tried to do some stuff with equalization for all of the schools. We equalize on Americans with Disability. We equalize on other formula basis. But we constrained some of the small schools that were closer. And I'm just questioning whether that is an intelligent thing to continue, given the fact that we're no longer trying to force schools to collapse. So I think that is the question that really is embodied by this bill.
And Mr. I think it's a good question, and I think the solution is to come up with this extra $2.6 million to solve it.
Yeah. What she said.
But coming up with the extra $2.6 million means we take it out of social services or police and fire.
We don't necessarily have to do that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, we're 44th out of 50 states in terms of corporate load, tax load. We haven't had any discussion about tax reform in the building. We're just talking about, we won't call it zero sum, we're talking about a fixed budget with no increased revenue and increased needs on the other hand.
Well, and Mr. Senator Corcoran, I hope you'll be here for the lively discussion that we'll attend Senator Miller's proposal that we eliminate the tax credit for political contributions, because in point of fact, we are going to be looking at revenue enhancements in this committee. What I've said before is that it is not a zero-sum game. I mean it. It is not a zero-sum game. It can go up or down. Ma'am, you have been very quiet and very patient for this lively discussion about this little bill, Senate Bill 509. Would you like to add to the public record, ma'am? Do you want to offer any testimony? Or just give a hearty hi, oh, me?
No shy people are allowed in this building.
No shy people allowed. I don't really think I have anything to add to the discussion today.
Thank you.
It's been very interesting.
Then I will ask if any other person here present wishes to offer testimony on Senate Bill 509. I see heads are shaking up. Ladies and gentlemen, we did not plan to have a work session on 509 today. The intention is that we array all of the bills that will mess with the formula together. And in fact, we're even considering possibly an omnibus bill that looks at all of the formula tweakage together, and that will be one approach. The intention is that we take a very comprehensive look. In deference to testimony that we received yesterday from Mr. Rose, who said that we should look at all of these side by each, we will do that. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 509. I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 252. We had additional testimony that was not possible to bring to the committee yesterday, so we'll go to Senate Bill 252. Colleagues, do we need a refresher on what Senate Bill 252 does and what it is? That was the one that changes the percentage of special education students who qualify for the additional weighting factor. So that was the one that we were looking at the request of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Mr. Bunn. I will call Steve Johnson from the Department of Education from Marion County, who was very patient with us and allowed us to defer his testimony. Mr. Johnson, you have the floor.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Johnson, Associate Superintendent for the Office of Special Education, Oregon Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding our support for Senate Bill 252, which is a technical bill that adjusts the current limitation on the numbers of students a district can claim to receive the special education income from 11% to 13%. This bill also would allow for periodic review and for adjustment. This bill does not change the total dollars available in the state school fund. In fact, it has no impact on the amount of the state school school fund. This bill, however, would reduce unnecessary paperwork for districts. It would provide funding and income for districts in the year that the district needs the funding. It would provide more accurate information on income for district planning, accounting, and expenditures. And finally, this bill, taking effect in July, would reflect the Oregon of today, not the Oregon of the last century. In 1991, 11% was established as the limit that a district could claim a second wage as part of the state school fund for students with disabilities. At that time, 10.8% of children in Oregon schools were identified as being disabled. At that time, Fairview Hospital was still in operation. At that time, our medical capability was not such that students who were born had a lifelong expectancy. That has changed now in 2001. Fairview is closed. Our medical services are better. Our educational technology is better. When the 11% cap was established, an exception was provided as part of a waiver process. But now the exception is the norm. The state percentage currently is 12.8%, just below the national percentage. More districts are above the 11% than are below it. Since 1992, the number of districts applying for 11% waivers has gone from 79 districts to 159 districts. This year, over 80% of our districts in the state applied for waivers to exceed the 11% cap. During the same time, during the last 10 years, the number of school-age children in the state identifying as being disabled went from 54,000 to over 66,000. This cap is a funding cap established by the state. The district still has the obligation to serve any and all students identified as being disabled, regardless of the percentage of students with disabilities in that district, regardless of the income that the district receives from the state school fund. Districts do receive the federal funds for all their students with disabilities, regardless of the percentage of students in that district. The department responds to concerns about over-identification by annually auditing districts, inspecting individualized education programs and eligibility determination for students with disabilities, ensuring that all students who are identified as disabled are done so properly, are receiving the services that are on the IEP, that there are no phantom children being reported. We believe that by providing districts the money that they need to serve kids with disabilities in the year that they need that money will actually enhance the ability of a district to provide special education and related services, and will remove one of the areas of conflicts between districts and parents, the concern over money. Thank you very much. I'd be pleased to answer any of your questions.
We have heard testimony opposing Senate Bill 252, and the proposition that was put forward in that testimony, to characterize it, was that we shouldn't mess with this formula that we've established for distributing funds. But the superintendent of public instruction testified that what we have is a statutory limitation of 11%, but an actual expenditure closer to 12.8 because of the exception factor, because of the ability of school districts to petition and get adjustments based on an individual need. And I'm wondering if you could describe to the committee the paper chase that you alluded to in your earlier testimony, and comment on whether or not you think that the statutory change to 13 more accurately reflects what's reality, or whether or not we should stick with the 11% and continue to chase the paper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over the 10 years that this waiver process has been in place, we have attempted to reduce the amount of paper that a district must complete and file as much as possible. And we've been able to distill the form down to two sides of one piece of paper. However, that single sheet of paper that a district must submit does not reflect the hours that a district must go through to justify and collect and analyze the information that then is summarized on that one piece of paper. With the database initiative, which this legislature has so strongly supported, this year for the first time we have what we believe are some accurate figures on the expenditures in special education. In the next 2 years, we expect those figures to be refined, made more accurate, as districts become aware of how the information is analyzed, and we support and assist the districts in reporting accurately. So in terms of the paper, what we find is that there are actually districts which are eligible to submit a request for an exception, but because of the paperwork requirements, do not do so.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, this proposed change, does this get to the issue of the caseload concerns that special education teachers have? Are we, by changing this, doing this tweak to the formula, and does the change in the funding help that effort in any way, or that issue, address that issue in any way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo, to a certain extent, yes, it would, because it will deliver the income that's needed for the amount of students with disabilities that a district is serving in the year that they're serving them. Therefore, the district is assured of that income up to 13% and can plan, hire, and support staff. That should, if done properly, reduce the caseload issue.
Okay.
However, other elements, other factors really have much more of an effect on the caseload than this factor alone.
Okay. Thank you.
The committee may benefit from knowing about a little more about the Department of Education's review committee. You know, the application process triggers a review at the Department of Education. How is that committee constituted? What do they do? What was the criterion used to approve or disapprove? Was that group chosen? A little more information about the exception process, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to describe that. There is a 11% review committee that is established annually. It is a group composed of educators external to the department. The department staffs the committee but does not participate in the recommendation to the state superintendent. The committee is composed of superintendents of school districts, special education directors, business managers, business officers of school districts, and representatives from education service districts. Those folks convene for a two-day period in Salem. And after having reviewed information sent to them, the application information sent to them, they then analyze the information. They determine the accuracy and the persuasiveness of the information based on, to a great extent, objective, quantifiable data, and then determine the amount that is sought for an exception, how much should be awarded. That then is placed into a recommendation made to the state superintendent for his action. This year, the committee recently met and they are recommending an adjustment of over $16 million for the state school fund. The impact of that to districts throughout the state for all students, not just students with disabilities, is a deduction or a reduction of $15 per ADM for every student. If the 13% limitation is established, that kind of adjustment for every state school fund basic would not be required, and districts would not find 18 months after they closed the books on a budget that they, in fact, didn't have the money to spend that they thought they had to spend. Mr. Chair, I don't know if that responded to all of the issues you had.
It does in part. I guess the other question was just the process, the constitution of, and the issue of fairness in administering that program upon which so many small school districts is dependent.
Those individuals are chosen to, in addition to the different roles that they represent, to reflect districts and ESDs throughout the state. They come from small districts to large districts, so they are truly representative of the entire state system of education. The information that they analyze is consistent, and as I said, to a great extent, it is quantifiable information that can be put into a formula approach. A district does have the opportunity to identify in narrative special factors or considerations that they believe should assist in making their case to exceed the 11% waiver. So there is a certain amount of subjective judgment, but it is, we've worked over the last several years to limit that. We do require that districts demonstrate that they have spent the full amount of the second weight that they receive for students in special education. So this money is not given if a district hasn't spent that second weight. We also count in, as part of their expenditures, the money and services that a district receives from an education service district for special education. So we try to take into account all sources of income and support for special ed.
Any questions, further questions? I guess the following on the superintendent's testimony, it just seems that we would be doing in statute what we're doing by exception, that we're really already approaching the level of 13% readjustments in this formula. And your testimony is that we wouldn't be increasing the transfer beyond a measure that we're already doing with the exception process. I guess what I'm trying to make clear for the record is we have an 11% factor. We have an exception process. We're averaging significantly higher than the statutory 11%. But we're already spending the money. We're already making the transfers. We're doing the rearranging that Senator Corcoran referred to already. I guess I'd like to ask you to just characterize that for the record.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I think you have captured the kernel of the issue that we have had to create and pursue a process that now has become very bureaucratic, very time-consuming, and with this bill would be unnecessary. This process right now is, in fact, a paper performance, and this bill reflects reality.
And the other, I guess the other caveat we have to put in the record is that changing the statutory percentage would still leave in place the ability of districts to take a very special case to the exception process through the Department of Education and still have those needs addressed if that was necessary.
Mr. Chair, yes, this bill would not remove the exception process.
Questions? Senator Vanis.
Trying to refresh my memory. The last discussion we had on this issue, we talked a little bit about federal funds and how much federal money was going to be available. And just for my mind, I need some clarification with respect to where that federal money is and if that's in addition to whatever amount is provided through the ADMW or not. And I don't know if we want to get into that discussion here or if it's more appropriately dealt with in Senator Starr's committee. But.
Well, actually, just a brief. Our state dollars do leverage some federal dollars, and there are some federal dollars available for these programs. Can you just briefly characterize that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, briefly, the federal dollars that we receive through the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act are in addition to the state school fund dollars. The federal dollars are restricted. They must only be used for students with disabilities. And if I may, just the amount that currently is distributed this year is approximately $636 per child with disability. Next year, that amount will grow to $813 for each child with disability in the state.
Mr. Chairman, how is disability defined?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, identifies 12 categories of disability, and it defines within that act the characteristics and evaluation findings that must be there in the process to go through for each of those categories. Those criteria and that process is then mirrored in Oregon law and statute, and an evaluation team considers each child, the information made available by the parent, and also made available through the assessment of each child using individualized tests, tools, and measures.
Mr. Chairman.
A follow-up question?
That was a wonderful answer, except it doesn't tell me anything.
Didn't tell you, okay.
And I'm sure you're accurate. It didn't really get to the point.
Okay.
I mean, are we talking about children with disabilities that are physical disabilities as opposed to mental impairment or behavioral disabilities, this kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, excuse me, Senator Minnis, for talking about process and not the actual categories. Among the 12 categories, yes, we are talking about those children that you mentioned. We're talking about children with autism spectrum disorder, blindness, hearing impairments, orthopedic impairments, traumatic brain injury, learning disabilities, speech and language impairments, mental retardation, and other health impairments that impair the vitality and learning ability of a child.
Senator Minnis, categories are arrayed in the handout.
Are they?
And I just was advised that myself by Steve.
So, what, Mr. Chairman, if I could, Mr. Johnson, what would be an emotional disturbance? What?
Have you been carefully observing the? Oh, never mind.
I know. I'll be talking about Senator Corcoran again.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis. An emotional an emotional disturbance would be a disability caused by mental illness or mental health impairment. Could include schizophrenia, dissociative disorder, wide variety of recognized, medically recognized as well as educationally recognized mental health concerns. One significant issue is that a medical diagnosis of a condition is not sufficient solely to make a child eligible for special education. A child must require specially designed instruction in order to benefit from education due to that disability. There are children who have disabilities who aren't in special ed. Those children do not require specially designed instruction.
Mr. Chairman, who makes that determination and how is that accomplished?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that determination is made by a team of educators, people who are expert in the area of evaluation, and by the child's parent, considering all available information on the child and determining whether or not the child meets the state and federal eligibility criteria. That determination is reviewed, and the child is reevaluated at least every 3 years.
And of course, Senator Minnis, that's the place where the rub is created. That's where there's conflict between parents, school district administrators, program administrators, funding agencies. I think all of us at various times as representatives of constituents have had constituents who have had a determination and lost it, or who want a determination and can't seem to get it. So.
All right. And just kind of to, I guess, this all started with your early comment about a reduction in paperwork. I got, my assumption now is that's a fairly, two questions. One, do you have any financial analysis with respect to savings in terms of reduced paperwork? And is that paperwork just simply by the increase from 11% to 13% and the fact that they won't have to submit papers that they're currently now having to do to justify? And there's kind of a third background side of this, and that's the justification that we might be involved in terms of developing paperwork that is more defense-oriented to defend ourselves against lawsuits and or other kinds of actions that might be filed by parents who disagree.
Senator Minnis, I think Steve has some information about that.
Great.
So research, if you just go ahead and present that.
From the numbers that I've looked at, it appears that about 50 districts would not have to go through the waiver process because they would be within, between the 11% and the 13%, they would max out. So the 13% would cover all of their special education students, and there wouldn't be any reason for them to go through the waiver process.
So, Mr. Chairman, how many other districts would then still have to do that? I mean,
about 100.
Would still have to go through it.
They would be above. The 13% is an average. So roughly half the districts would be above, half would be below. Mm-hmm. So you'd still have 100 districts that could potentially apply through the waiver process.
However, if the federal funds increase in the following year, as we've heard testified, it's possible that even some of those would not have to seek the exception process, assuming that their costs would be covered by the federal distributions.
I guess maybe a question for committee staff. 13%, is that adequate, or should it be 14%, or should it be another number? Is it just as a flip a coin, and here we are? And
whatever criteria that you want to use.
But it kind of goes back to the question of whether or not there's been any quantification of any savings. I mean, if there's a legitimate savings within school districts, they don't have to spend hours justifying a waiver process. And can we act? Is there any accuracy in trying to reflect how many kids are out there? Should an additional 100 school districts have to use the waiver process? I don't know.
Well, I'm under the impression, after listening to Superintendent Bunn's testimony, that there will always be exceptions because the school district simply cannot anticipate what disabilities students may bring to the educational system. Mm-hmm. And so there was obviously an intent to preserve the waiver process. The testimony from Superintendent Bunn was that this reflected the largest amount of paperwork reduction and recognized what is actually happening, the largest feasible amount that they could bring forward and justify. So I guess we could refer to Superintendent Bunn's testimony or bringing back or ask Mr. Johnson to characterize that for us. But I know that was not an arbitrarily selected number. It was based on how much paperwork, and I don't know whether or not there was a savings analysis, a cost-benefit ratio analysis done. But Mr. Johnson, you know, how did we pick the number 13?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, and members of the committee, number 13 was based on anticipating potential growth in the future so that we wouldn't have to come back in the near future and request an additional increase, with the state average at 12.8%, the national average hovering just above 13%. We believe that 13% reflected a legitimate number, at least for the next 10 years. As to the amount of paperwork that this particular bill would save, we're probably only looking at, if you're
If you're running a program, every minute that you can save is precious. But we're looking at between 1 to 5 days of an administrator, clerk, accounting office, staff time. May I just also remark that this itself will not reduce the need to provide documentation of eligibility for students. That will continue. All this does is remove an administrative paperwork burden from a district, hopefully allowing that administrator to provide more time and supervision and program improvement.
You're kind of bouncing between different questions. I would like to see a quantification of savings dollars. It's just fascinating to me in the 15 years I've been in this process that every time I introduce a bill that has a fiscal impact, well, you know, for some reason agencies can come in here with, you know, a dollar for dollar impact, and it shows up, and by God, they can come up with it in a heartbeat. But when an agency has a bill, it's always indeterminate, and we don't know, but we think there might be some savings. You know, I just honestly think that there should be kind of a balance on both sides. It sounds to me like there's some legitimate savings. I think we ought to be able to articulate that in terms of our argument, justification, and, you know, I guess legislative record, too, that we're doing it for
a reason
that makes sense as opposed to some other thing.
Senator Vince, we have the luxury of time in this instance because this is one of those bills that we will array with other formula adjustments that are being proposed.
Mr. Chair, if we could, I don't know if Steve wants to do this, but the issue of maybe looking at bumping it up another 0.5% and seeing if that would reduce, if we can get a cost savings, and if that figure means anything, if you can bump it up to 13.5% and fewer schools have to go through this, is that savings worth doing, at least so the committee can have those figures?
Let's take two approaches. First, we'll get the justification for the 13%. We'll see if we can do the cost-benefit analysis that you've referred to and have that available before the next time this bill appears before the committee. And then if you'll meet with committee staff for just a minute and talk about that analysis on 13.5 or other tweaks, other adjustments that might be made, I think you'll get an answer. Matter of fact, I know you will. Senator Minnis. Is there anyone else who has a question for Mr. Johnson while we have him before us? If not, I'll ask if anyone else here present has additional testimony on Senate Bill 252 they'd like to add to the record.
Oh, we can make Ozzy beat up on him a little bit.
Mr. Rose is not on the balls of his feet. I don't know whether he wishes to testify or not. He spoke his name and invoked him. It's just like rubbing a bottle.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, members of the committee, I'm Ozzy Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I did sign up yesterday, so I thought that I was on a list.
Oh.
But I'm also cheered by your comment. This will be part of the overall look at what we're doing. The only thing I would add to the information you've had today is that we're hopeful that we won't do this session and that you will take this interim. We have a lot better data on the database initiative now. Senator George was involved in learning quite a bit about how big the problem is with the high-cost kids. And the move from 11 to 13 does one thing, but we would hope that you will leave it alone 11, go through this biennium, and take a really good look at the total amount we're spending. There's some other State Department data that one of Steve's staff gave me yesterday, and the difference between what we're spending and what they have, counting ESD and federal and local, is enormous. The problem is big. It's bigger than this, and it needs to be addressed, I think, in a lot more detail and a focus on, I think you've heard us talk about the 4X, 3X kind of thing, and that's a huge number if you get into that, but there's got to be a way to get a handle on how we're going to fund these kids and do it well for all districts. And the run you have ought to be interesting for you, though, as legislators, because it's a different mix of winners and losers. It's inside your own counties. You look at it, it's really all over the map. And a lot of school districts who are in favor of this probably aren't as soon as they see these numbers, by the way.
Mr. Rose, I understand that. The winners and losers things got me a little bit upset.
I understand that.
The idea that the losers are people who don't get their needs met.
Yes.
You don't win because you have more disabled children in your school district.
Yes, sir. But we all will win if we figure out a way to adequately fund all the special ed kids in a fair way. That's the, and we're not.
Okay, I need some help on two curves that cross.
I know that.
Here's one curve. Don't do anything now because the problem's going to be addressed later and it's bigger.
Yeah.
And you know that's out there and that's a certain logic that delaying for more data is an approach. I don't know if it's an approach that gets at the root of the issue because we don't know whether the revenue stream will ever catch the need. It won't. Maybe we do know, but it won't. It's unlikely to anyway. And the other thing is we have before us something that seems to be rational, seems to be based on some feedback that we have before us now, which is we know that 11% is the statutory limitation, but we're using an exception process that puts an administrative burden on schools that we could alleviate, at least in the next 2 years, while we get more data to prove that we have more need that we can't meet. So those curves are crossing when they cross in this bill. So the question is, do we do something that we see is logical? And with Senator Minnis' administrations and demands, we will get some analysis that we can do with numbers that we have. Senator Minnis.
Are you done?
I am done.
Okay, good. Because actually, I wanted to get back to it's kind of an admonition or request, kind of throwing something out there. The thing I've been harping on so far this session is attendance. You know, my first swipe at the ADMW, I think we should have a component in there dealing with attendance somehow and how that deals with that. But I want to ask the committee to maybe take a good look at a program that our Judiciary Committee went up and looked at just this last week. And that was a school attendance initiative that they have in Multnomah County that's actually initiated by the county, and I think they spent about $3 million in doing this program. But the reason I'm raising the issue now is it kind of relates back to the kids with special needs, because what they're finding is that where these youngsters are not showing up in school, you know, grade 1 through 8, and to the extent that they can increase their attendance in those early years, the behavioral problems they have as they grow older are minimized. So in one sense, you can look at, you know, these people with disabilities, whether it's whatever its origin is, and try to deal with it as they get older, you know, where it may be uncontrollable or more difficult to deal with, or have some kind of an issue that deals with school attendance. And their program is really pretty fascinating. It's tied in with the juvenile justice program. But what they actually do is they have an attendance, I guess, monitor that they literally are notified when a kid does not show up for school 3 days out of 15, they literally send somebody out to that person's house, knock on the door, and ask the parent why the child's not in school and follow up on that kind of a social service model and try to facilitate getting the kid back at school. I don't know if that's related or not, but it seems to me like that's a pretty neat program, and I don't know if it should be a component of the distribution formula or where we're directing monies to be spent, but at least it seemed like it had a pretty substantial value in the metro area that I come from. So, again, it may be an issue that Senator Starr is interested in or not, but if you have an opportunity to go up and look at that program, and it's at the Donald Lee Long home, that's where we met with these folks, pretty fascinating. Ozzy, I don't know, do you have anything to do with that, or are you aware of it?
No, sir.
No? All right.
Attendance can.
Well, but and the interesting thing is $3 million is coming out of the county general fund to deal with that particular issue. Oh, well. I thought it was fascinating.
Senator Minnis, I think it's part of the equation. Thank you. And if we do end up doing something with school funding formulas that are based on attendance will become vastly more important to school districts. Thank you. Is there anyone here present who wishes to offer additional testimony on Senate Bill 252? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 252. Colleagues, we have on the agenda, Senate Bill 260. I don't know if anybody signed up for that. Yes, there have been. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 260 and call forth Mr. Salinas. And Ms. McKim, is that correct?
Yeah.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. excuse me. I'm Miguel Salinas. I'm president of a small corporation named HEART. It stands for Hispanic Education Advocacy Resource Team. It's a mouthful. We're going to try to change the name. But we're here to discuss some issues relative to our changing demographics, and I'd like to introduce our HEART Secretary and Treasurer, Linda McKim-Bell.
Hello.
I also like to point out that as advocates, we are volunteers. We're not paid staff. We don't have any practice in lobbying. We are new at this environment, so we will do the best job we can. The national move of No Child Will Be Left Behind belongs to each and every one of us. I think that school districts, State Department of Education, and ESDs across the state form a very strong triangle, if you will, to help every child in our state. A few months ago, there was a conference here at the Capitol building to which many of the leadership attended. It was called In America 2000, Oregon State Legislature. Do you all by any chance remember that conference? Much data was shared with leadership trying to increase the awareness of our educational crisis across the state as it relates to minority population. As HEART members, we have been researching the formulas that have been put in place, and I don't envy your job or those that have to apply the formulas. I also don't envy the jobs of those that have to spend the money. But we have found that there is some pretty obvious disparity between those families that have folks to support them within the political realm and those families that have no one. And we are talking about the Latino families in the state of Oregon, which at the present time, the student population on a percentage basis surpasses the white population in terms of new students entering the school system. As an institution or as a business, which education is somewhat of a business, we need to take a look at how the supply and demand is being applied here. We have a great deal of demand for special education teachers, English as a second language teachers, you name it. We have the needs out there. And since the inception of House Bill 3565 and Measure 5, which was approximately 10 years ago, school districts, ESDs, and State Department of Education have had an opportunity to use this map to identify needs and to also identify the new clients, although they're not new clients. Hispanics have been around for quite some time. I know I've been around for 50 years, you know, so that... Today we are here to support Senate Bill 260, and we also like to share just some thoughts for your consideration. There's no doubt that our school system is undergoing unprecedented change. School reform and changing demographics and the incidence of students with special needs is increasing significantly. While education service districts provide direct services and technical assistance to school districts, from HEART's perspective, they do not face as much public scrutiny and accountability than school districts themselves. In Hart's research, we have found that students represent an important commodity to the school districts. I hate to use the word, but that's really what it is, and I think that you mentioned in your in the previous conversation, students are a factor in terms of generating revenue. Depending on the student's needs, an individual student may generate as much as $9,000 or $10,000 for a school district. This equation can be seen in schools or districts where a significant number of students have either special needs, such as Title I, Title I-M, or are English language learners and other categories. The ESDs provide, I think, a very strong arm to educating these kids. We recommend that whatever formula you create can continue to support ESD efforts in providing quality services and also to review the methods of accountability. This accountability should also include an assessment of their infrastructure. And by infrastructure, I don't mean buildings, I mean the personnel infrastructure, which takes, you know, 80 or 85% of the budget. I think that over time, as I mentioned earlier, we have been in this new mode of operation with respect to House Bill 3565 and Measure 5 for almost 10 years. And presently, Hart is conducting research in terms of how much the infrastructure has changed over a 10-year period. And if you were to look at the reports that the State Department of Education creates with respect to their personnel profiles, which just counts, you know, people and if they're what ethnic group they are and so forth, they don't take into account the professional expertise. But I think that as we continue to look at revenue sources, whether it be for ESDs or other entities, I think it would be in our best interest across the board to look at the infrastructure that has been developed over the last 10-year period. Because by doing that, it can also provide you with a baseline from which to draw and make recommendations or decisions regarding the future revenue. Again, we support the notion that ESDs are part of that triangle. And I will go back and see if I can find the more copies of the report in the America 2000 Oregon State Legislature, because the profiles that are included in this report is not a pretty story when you are an African American or a Latino.
Mr. Salinas, if you will leave your copy with our staff,
that would be,
we will make available copies to each of
you. Wonderful. Members. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Appropriate number of copies.
I will do that. Record. Thank you so much. And let me just cite one window. Of every 100 Latino kindergartners, 63 will graduate from high school. 35 will complete at least some college. And 8 will obtain at least a bachelor's degree. I alluded to personnel infrastructure. With these numbers and with the population rate the way it's growing, I think it doesn't take much math to figure out that not only are we behind now, but if these numbers do not change to the positive, we will be on the negative for another 10, 20, 30 years. So I thank you for your time, and I will give the copy to the young lady here so she can pass it on to you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Question. Senator Stern?
Yes, I appreciate your testimony. And is that the Education Trust, Katie Hickott report?
Yes, sir.
I thought it might be. I was there for the presentation, and it was an outstanding presentation. Beyond what you've said regarding the Hispanics, other information there indicates that 30% of high school seniors are reading at the fourth grade level. I suspect you'd find a disproportionate number of those seniors who are Hispanic. And it's a tragedy that we're not teaching every child to read in the first grade.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Starr, the disparities in terms of academics can be found in national and state and local literature, and I'm glad you raised the point. What has not happened over the years is that the infrastructure with respect to personnel and teacher training has not been there. I happen to have had the honor of serving kids in a teacher and principal capacity for 32 years. And over time, I have seen a few success stories, but now with the population and the type of population that we are drawing to the state, it's something that we should all be concerned about. Whether you are an organization, professional organization, such as OEA, OSBA, COFALT, COSA, and so forth. Because we are here as members of that organization, and the kids are the ones that generate the dollars. They are the clients. And let me just tell you a little bit about some families that I've been representing, and I do represent about 10 families in my volunteer time. What happens to a 15-year-old who is now having behavioral problems, cannot deal with the environment at 10th grade, and cannot do the homework, and cannot take the homework home and have the parents help them with their homework. This child did not all of a sudden, he did not fail in 10th grade. He failed back in kindergarten, first grade, or second, or third grade. And I think there's enough research out there to suggest if by third grade you don't have a pretty good handle on things, mathematically, over time, you're just not going to gain the ground that you should gain. And I think that if you look at the profiles of professional development, especially with respect to the endorsements and credentialing programs that TSPC provides. And I'm anxious to get more information on this topic, because if you were to look at the infrastructure and then look at the student body, whether it be in Salem, where I volunteer, whether it be in Portland, where I volunteer, and I'm talking not volunteer for the school district, but for families, I think that it would be quite clear in terms of the direction that one needs to take. And let me go back to that triangle. If school districts, ESDs, and State Department of Education cannot strengthen the relationship and going beyond revenue and going beyond ORSs and so forth and really looking at the bottom line in terms of achievement, we are going to be having this kind of conversation 20, 30 years from now. Thank you for your question.
Well, I just wanted to verify then that I would assume that you would be supportive of the governor's enhancements in the education budget with regard to mentoring and can't remember what the other two programs were, but they're specifically designed to look at achievement gap issues.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Corcoran, I'm here to support public education. What I'm saying is that let's look at the finer pieces of public education. I am 55 years old. I've always been a conservative in terms of how I look at things, and sometimes more money is not the answer. If we can say more money with some real changes in terms of the infrastructure, then I think that we are targeting on the problem. If we were saying more money so we can have more of the same, then I respectfully say we need to think twice about that.
Sam, did you wish to add to the public record?
Yes.
We're already over our time for this morning. But
it's going to be very short.
Thank you, ma'am.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Linda McKim-Bell, and I come to the Hart Corporation as a retired ESL and migrant teacher of 20 years in Oregon. I've listened to arguments this morning about funding formula, and it brings up the theme of accountability and using money well. As you well know, ESDs are usually a service conduit, but sometimes they give money directly to school districts so that they can provide their own services. One example of this is the $2,840,879 that Multnomah ESD provides to PPS, Portland Public Schools, for ESL services this year for English as a Second Language services. In spite of the request for less paperwork, I would like to urge you to provide an accountability mechanism to ensure the public that ESL funds that come from ESDs are in fact spent for their intended purposes. School districts should be encouraged to use their ESL funding appropriately to meet the challenge of giving Hispanic students a first-rate education. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions from the committee? I do have a tendency to believe that within the funding formulas and the distributions, the legislature's torn between the concept of accountability and the idea of allowing managers on the site to reallocate resources to the need as they see the need. I believe that Mr. Salinas' testimony is absolutely accurate, that I have been in classrooms in my district, in schools where we've got 24 kids in a class, 8 are Hispanic-speaking children. This is a low primary grade, second grade. The teacher is not bilingual. There is no English as a second language coordinator in the school, although we have in the district, English is a second language component at the ESD level. And so you have to wonder what kind of education are those 8 children receiving, and what kind of a burden is being placed on that teacher who's not bilingual. And it seems to me that the small errors that we make in the primary grades are magnified over time, which is exactly the point of your testimony. So I appreciate it very much.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any suggestions for how you would include an accountability factor, or how you would do that? Or, and I guess part of that question is, in your statement, there's kind of an assumption that ESL monies are not being spent for ESL purposes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, that's a well-known fact. In fact, our research pretty much proves that. I will capitalize on our new Secretary of Education, Dr. Page, and that is that an informed community and informed parents can change the status quo. That's pretty reasonable and pretty real. The unfortunate thing is that the minority communities are not all that connected with school districts. The school districts over time, again, I like to emphasize, have not built the relationships and the infrastructure and personnel to create bridges of communication and understanding. A simple translation of a pamphlet to give to Mr. Gonzalez is not going to do it, because more than likely, that pamphlet is written at such a level that they're not going to understand it. And the families that I represent, none of them have understood that document that comes from either the State Department of Education or the school districts, because many times these parents will not have that reference point of PE, cafeteria, second grade, and so forth, not our reference point. So then what I've been trying to do is I go out and advocate, and I meet with superintendents, and I meet with school boards, I have met with the Oregon Department of Education, is that we need to have a campaign that emphasizes appropriate communication to the client. Because without appropriate communication, we're not going to get the parents to be, you know, part of this relationship. And something else is that most school districts are trying to do a good job, but they don't really know their clients that well. And I think that's pretty reflective on the communications plans that they have, and is reflected also on the bottom line of academics. So I just like to say that with the new thrust of parents can make a difference and empowered parents can change the status quo, I think that school leadership, whether it be state, ESDs, or any entity, should not be afraid of sharing the information that is necessary so that the Gonzaleses, the Mothershefs, the Van Nguyens, and other linguistic groups and cultural groups can then be armed with the information necessary to not only help their child, but also interface with school districts and institutions so they themselves can advocate for their own needs.
You make a good sense to me. Now, I want to kind of see if I understand what you just said. You're not saying that there's some evil inherent in the misspending of ESL dollars. If I understand what you're saying that they're maybe not spending it in a way that has a value to the communities that they're trying to reach, that we're making some assumptions about how we reach minority populations with, you know, with non-English speaking groups. They're not just spending it for something completely different than ESL.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mills, I would never regard anyone as evil, but I would regard them as maybe a very deliberate mismanagement. Deliberate in the sense that if I get 50 cents to provide a program for a child and I spend 25 cents, that's a pretty deliberate act. It may not be evil, but it's pretty deliberate. And let me just go back to, we have had a window of time of 10 years. And if we could have a study in terms of what the infrastructure change has been, that's what's going to answer your question more directly, and I think that with more substance than I can.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, if I could follow up on that, I think, you know, what we hear a lot of Latino parents complaining about is that the schools do get extra funding for ESL programs and ESL students, but they don't see, you know, a rich support of programs to help those students. And the question is, well, if you get extra funding, why isn't there more support to help those students? And what happens is that the districts will plug that funding into their overall funding base. And I realize that districts are in a very, you know, dealing with very tight budgets, and they're trying to make every dollar stretch as much as they can. But what happens is those dollars don't necessarily go for, you know, directly towards those students. And I think that just more and more people are talking about that and are concerned about it. I get invited around the state a lot to go to talk to Latino students at various schools, and I visited one, and I think it was in the Oregon City area. There's a high school, and there was this club of Latino students that had started, and I was meeting with them, and one of the teachers of the program said, you know, we get extra money, our school gets extra money for these students, but they don't get any. She was complaining that the services were just so meager to help them, and so I think we really do need to have a discussion about how those monies are being used, and but I also know that it's not a lack of caring situation, it's a lack of resources in general type of situation for these districts, and just trying to make the best use of every dollar they have. It's just that it's frustrating because people know that they do get extra money for ESL students and feel like the extra programs, you know, aren't showing up as a result of it.
So I think we need to understand something, and if the chairman does nothing else, it's at least to point out the obvious. the weighted ADMW and the formula enhancements for transportation, for instance, in rural districts is 1.7 per student, or a 0.70 addition for transportation. There are some school districts that get the weighted average for transportation and only have a 4-day school week. So arguably, you could say, well, they didn't use all the money they got for transportation in that category. There are schools that get weighted averages for folks with disability, but not all the dollars are treated as an entitlement. They are not an entitlement appropriation. They're an additional amount appropriated in consideration that these conditions, a heavy ESL population, a heavy Americans with disabilities question, a lot of need for independent education programs, they cause systemic stress across the board. They are coming to be regarded as entitlement. They are not entitlement. If we intend them to be entitlement, we need to restructure how those services are, or how our legislation reflects the intent. I think the question that I heard very clearly from Mr. Salinas is that we should look at services that are being provided and ask ourselves whether those are adequate to the need. And in those areas where we have rapidly growing Hispanic populations, it's very clear that those services don't meet the need. And that's the issue. And the cost of that isn't just dollars. The cost of that is lost opportunity, less productivity, lifetime, and higher dropout rates, and a systemic disempowerment of a segment of the community that otherwise would be incredibly productive. And so the question is not, are we putting more money in, or even are we making entitlements in our legislative efforts? The question is, are the services getting to where they need to go? I think the answer is that's probably not happening in all cases. The argument that we get caught in is whether these things are actually entitlements. And we lose those arguments. Is that we didn't intend them to be entitlements. Parents regard them as entitlements, and so what we're doing is creating an expectation that can't be met. So that is where we get into trouble with parents and administrators and teachers, and that's why by almost any means you can find a way to define this education system as failing, when in point of fact the statistics Mr. Salinas gave us are vastly improved over what we would have found if we surveyed them a decade ago. If we looked at the dropout rates and some of the other rates that we've seen that are abysmally bad by current comparison, if we went back 10 years, they'd be worse. So I think we're doing better. The question is, how fast are we able to improve the system? And are we really meeting the greatest needs? Mr. Salinas, your testimony has been very, very important and extremely thoughtful, and I think it's given the committee a great deal more to think about. You're noted in the record as supporting Senate Bill 260. I think there are elements there that you certainly would support, maybe other elements that you would not. But what I got out of your testimony is that you want us to look at services and accountability.
Yes. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That ends the public hearing on Senate Bill 260. We are in adjournment until Monday morning at 8:30.
Mr. Chair.